IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of All Things Policy. I'm your host for today, Kripa Koshi. I'm a program manager at the Takshashila Institution, and I'm really excited to cover the topic that we're going to discuss today with our guest. But not to leave you in suspense, allow me to just quickly introduce Anirudh. So Anirudh Dinesh, who's our guest today, is a research fellow at the GovLab and the Burns Center for Social Change, affiliated with Northeastern University. In this role, he conducts research on governance innovation. He's a member of the team that's designing and piloting experiments for new models of public engagement, what the GovLab calls people-led innovation, which the hope is to improve the legitimacy and the effectiveness of policymaking and to help solve urgent public problems. Anirudh holds a Bachelor's of Engineering in Electronics and Communications Engineering from the B&M Institute of Technology and a Master's degree in Computer Engineering from New York University. So that's a brief introduction for our guest today, but I'm going to maybe ask the first question maybe on listeners' mind. Anirudh, how did you make your way from the world of engineering into the world of public policy and governance?
So thank you for having me, Kripa. First of all, I'm very happy to be here. GovLab moved to New York University's School of Engineering explicitly with the goal of bringing together the policy world with the engineering world and sort of the technology world. Sometime in 2014 or 15. And I was doing my master's at NYU at the time. And GovLab's director, Professor Beth Novak, was teaching a course on governance innovation at the time. And I was her research assistant for that course. And until that point, I had no idea that there was so much activity and research and experimentation happening in the world of governance. And it really opened my eyes to the possibilities that emerge when you bring together engineering and technology with governance and public policy. Mm. So to sit at that intersection was a very kind of unique opportunity. And the vision for the future that Beth and the team at GovLab had was one that I found very inspiring. And it caught my attention. And so I stuck around as a full-time research fellow when I graduated, and it's been close to a decade now since I first joined.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. And we're happy that you've picked that path because you get to join us today and talk about all the cool stuff that you've been working on in this past decade. So I'm going to jump in maybe with just my first question, just to set the context for our listeners. In my introduction there, I mentioned the phrase people-led innovation. So the phrase may seem somewhat self-explanatory, but how would you sort of define people-led innovation in this specific context of public policymaking?
Yeah, I'll take a step back there and just go to the sort of what is the goal of the governance and the public policy that we're doing, and it is essentially to solve public problems. And at its core, the idea is that public problems are complex, they're global, they're what we call wicked problems, and they're really hard to tackle. And often we're sort of jumping to the solution rather than taking a step to think about what are the problems that we're tackling here. Mm. And so people-led innovation is a way to say, it's a different way of saying human-centered design or design thinking, which are sort of common principles that we've sort of heard and are slowly becoming more and more familiar with. How do we bring those concepts into public problem solving? And the sort of great designer Don Norman has this phrase he uses, which is humanity-centered design. Mm. How do you employ human-centered design in service of humanity and in service of the planet, and really in service of solving public problems? So people-led innovation is a methodology that we have designed that has precedence of a community at the core of defining and solving public problems.
Oh, fantastic. I quite like how you phrase that. And so when we go into, the problem-solving aspect of all of it that's at the heart of what we're trying to achieve, I'm sure that you would maybe say that there's an imperative for people to be involved in all stages of this problem-solving process. But I mean, in your view, would you say there's any specific point in this problem-solving cycle where you anticipate that, you know, there would be the greatest value for citizens or for people to be involved? Or do you feel like, you know, at every step and every stage, there's equal value for folks jumping in to pitch in and help solve problems?
I think there is value at every stage, right from the problem definition stage, which is, you know, where I feel we spend the least amount of time when we should be spending the most amount of time. Because the people who experience these problems or the ones who are impacted by these problems know the most about the problems. And we often miss the opportunity to ask them how they're impacted in their sort of lived experiences. How does this problem impact you? And defining the problem from the perspective of the people who are impacted by it, right? And so we're not, it's the mindset shift from saying we're solving problems for people to saying we're solving problems with people. And so can we involve people right at that stage from getting their feedback on how the problem exists and on defining the problem to then going to the solution identification stage next? But even at the, you know, think about hyper-local problems, right? Problems that you might be facing in daily life, trash collection, sanitation, traffic, designing recreational spaces, whatever it is, like that comes to mind, public transport. These are things that if you don't have a really clear idea of how it impacts people's daily lives, you're very often, even before you step into the solution identification stage, you've sort of already lost the connection with reality. So I would start there. If you move to the solution identification stage, then the fundamental idea that our communities are our greatest asset, the wisdom that exists in our community, the expertise that exists in our communities, however you define that word expertise, right? Like in the way that we think about this, expertise could be your credentialed expertise, the, you know, what you learn in your education or during the course of your work. But it could also be your sort of lived experience and how we can leverage your lived experience to identify solutions to the problems that we're trying to tackle. And then if you go all the way towards sort of, if you want to call it the end of the policy cycle, which is measurement and evaluation and really seeing how things are working in the real world, there's so much opportunity out there to get people involved in measuring the impact of the solutions that we implement. So I think at every stage of this process, there is scope for people to be involved, and there's a need to design mechanisms that allow people to participate at each stage.
Mm-hmm. I hear that. Thank you so much for sort of outlining that so well. I think a question that I would just love to hear your views on was sort of wondering about, and perhaps some of our listeners may be wondering, is why do you think that there's so much activity and attention oriented around solutions? And why is there this lack of attention, you think, typically to the problem-solving phase of the process?
Yeah, I think that has to do with, you know, the reality of the world that we live in. The people in positions of decision-making are there for a limited amount of time. And there's all sorts of pressures to get projects done in that limited amount of time with the resources that you have at that moment. And we're sort of always in the rush to build the app or launch the website or announce a new project or, you know, whatever it might be. And so it's not, I understand why people are rushing into the solution identification stage. But I think when we design these projects, we have to be intentional about spending some amount of time on the problem definition phase. And it's not, and not to let it sort of drag on for several months and, you know, just do nothing and sit around, but have in a very sort of focused way, a way to define problems by getting the right people in the room together and then understanding how you can reach out to people outside. And these are all things that are skills and kind of methodologies that are very learnable. And it's not, I don't think it's alien to anybody. It's just that we need some external force to bring everybody together at the start of a project to do this. And we, in fact, at the GovLab, we've done several workshops for groups of people, both inside and outside of government, who are trying to solve public problems, focused simply on the problem definition phase. And you can do this, you know, as a 2-hour long workshop. You could do it as a week long course. You can structure it in many ways. But the point I'm trying to make is there's very structured ways of doing problem definition. It's not simply opening a Google Doc and then just having discussions and sort of typing out things that people are saying. There's more sort of structured methods to doing problem definition that I think our public problems processes will benefit from.
Stay tuned to All Things Policy. We'll be right back after a short commercial break.
Just to pick up, I think, on the last point that you mentioned of tools that can be employed actually to engage with citizens for this policy problem-solving process, really. What do you sort of see as more traditional, or are there sort of emerging approaches to how we can best engage with citizens? And maybe it would be useful, I think, for listeners to have a few examples of some of these tools of how to best engage with citizens.
So traditionally, if you think about how citizens are involved in public life very broadly. You vote once in 4 years or once in 5 years, and then very rarely do you hear back from the people that you've voted into power, and we've sort of said, okay, we're outsourcing all our problem solving to you for 4 years. Come back to us when you're done. I think we need to change that idea of citizenship or the role of citizenship in public life fundamentally. But even then, in the past several decades, the ways that people have employed to hear from residents or constituents is things like town halls or running surveys, telephone surveys, long form surveys. And some people will the moment you say public engagement, the question that I get most often is, well, we're not Switzerland, we can't do referendums on every topic. It's simply not feasible. And that's true, right? Especially in a country like India, it's not feasible to do referenda for every topic out there. And in fact, I would argue that doing a binary choice referendum is often not the right way to tackle sort of nuanced, complex problems in any case. So then how do you think more creatively about how you, you know, leverage the expertise and the lived experience that we were talking about earlier, using new ways of working? And this is where I think technology can play a critical role as a tool to enable us to think more creatively about how we hear from large groups of people. So possibly the most common examples that we have heard of crowdsourcing, for those of us who have heard of crowdsourcing, is probably things like crowdfunding. Or one example that's fairly recent, and unfortunately keeps coming up all the time. I say unfortunately because this is about crowdsourcing disaster maps. So I remember in 2018 when there was the massive floods in Kerala, and government was really struggling to identify where resources need to be sent and what kind of resources need to be sent to which locations. And so a group of engineers, students, professionals, people who just knew how to work technology, all volunteers, set up using open source technology a map where people could report, here's what resources we need in these locations. And the people who were donating resources could then more efficiently send the resources that were necessary in specific locations. And this kind of crowdsourced disaster maps are happening more and more all over the world. I said unfortunately earlier because the disasters are happening more and more, unfortunately. But in many ways, the fact that we have these technologies that are now so readily deployable makes it easier for us to get critical resources to places faster. So crowdfunding we see all the time, people raising funds from the crowd for many social causes. These are kind of common examples that we've heard, but can we use the same idea that there are people willing to donate their time, their resources, their skill sets to solve public problems, right? So I'll walk through maybe two or three examples, and then we can see if we want to go deep into any of them.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
I would say there is this concept of citizen science, which is the idea that you want to run, you want to gather data for some science experiment or for some sort of evidence gathering as part of a project. And the best way to do it at a very large scale is to get people who are interested in that subject to help you sort of in a very decentralized way. This could be, bird watchers do this very often, where they report sightings of birds and then they'll just put it up on like an online database. It could be running what are known as tree censuses. So, if you want to know the sort of the range of biodiversity in a neighborhood, you ask people to take a picture of the trees in their neighborhood. If they can recognize it, they can tag it. And then you can make a really nice map of the biodiversity in your community.
Wow. It's kind of prompting me to spend more time outdoors. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. It's a great way to do kind of city walks and take, pictures of these things and just upload it somewhere where and do something that's helpful for a larger cause. But think about leveraging that kind of same methodology to measure water quality in different neighborhoods, right? You could do, there's a project called Safecast that was first launched in Japan after the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster in Japan. And people were, even though government said it's safe to go back to those neighborhoods, people were not convinced that the water there is safe to drink. And so Safecast essentially gave out gigacounters to people and said, let's measure radiation and see if it's actually safe to go back. And then you sort of build this map of radiation around that neighborhood, and then that showing the evidence to people that it is safe actually is the best way to convince people when you don't believe a source. Safecast now does water quality monitoring in the same way that it did radiation monitoring, and does it all over the world. Pulse Point is another example that I really like, which is we're familiar with the idea that when someone has a heart attack in a public space, there's, I think, the first 7 minutes or something is the most critical time when they need to be administered CPR just in order to save their lives. And often it's very hard to get an ambulance to somebody in that situation within 7 minutes. Pulse Point is an app that has registered CPR practitioners. They need not be nurses. They're just people who have taken a course on, CPR and are certified to give CPR. And you go on Pulse Point and say, okay, here's a person having a heart attack. Who's the closest certified CPR administrator in the area? And that person can come and help administer first aid. These are fairly creative ways of solving very hard problems, really. So we take that one step further and then think about how do we then leverage it now to gather citizens' feedback or citizens' expertise to tackle problems that we've identified. There's a platform called Your Priorities. It's built by an Icelandic foundation called the Citizens Foundation. It's open source. So if you go to the Citizens Foundation's website, you can play around with your priorities. And what it does is if a local municipal government is looking for ideas to improve the local park or looking for ideas to improve trash collection in the neighborhood, how do you get a large number of people to suggest ideas to tackle these problems? The one very important caveat there is we're not asking for people's opinions about the problems, right? There's a lot of kind of opinion giving that happens on social media, on Twitter and on Facebook, and it gets very messy and very argumentative. We're not looking for opinions. We're looking for expertise. We're looking for what is your experience of that problem? What can you contribute to solving that problem? And Your Priorities has this really nice interface where it asks you, it sort of prompts you to think through your own potential solution to tackle the problem that you want to contribute to. And it asks you to break down how does this solution address the problem? How much do you think it will cost? What kind of timelines do you think it will take? And you don't have to be accurate, fully accurate. You just need to think about it for a second and submit it on that platform. And the really nice thing about it is your priorities will then invite the larger community to comment on submissions that other people have made. And rather than having a comment section similar to Facebook, where people are having arguments about, oh, this is a terrible idea, or this is a great idea, your priorities has two very neatly laid out comment sections. One where you can say, here's why I think this idea will work. And one where you can say, I don't think this idea is great. I don't think it works at all. Or pros and cons, you know, whatever, the sort of counter arguments to someone's idea. And what that does is for the decision maker, it lays out very clearly what are the pros and cons in two separate columns. You can just, it's just right there for you to analyze. And for the people, it makes it a more constructive argument. It's not, it's disagreement, but it's not argumentative. And I think that's a critical difference to you know, sort of bringing about some sort of consensus or understanding of people's ideas. And then finally, the one thing that I really like that your priority does is it has a voting functionality, but it doesn't say, how do you like this idea or do you not like this idea? It's not an upvote or a downvote. It is to say, can we tweak that to say, we want you to vote on the basis of whether you think on a scale of 1 to 5, how feasible is this idea? Or how urgent is this idea to implement? And so you're getting people to vote on metrics rather than simply like, I like the person who submitted this idea, so yes, upvote or downvote. So I'm not saying this is the ideal solution, but it's a creative way of gathering a large number of people's inputs into a problem-solving process. And we can think of many other ways to kind of modify a solution like that, or a process like that. And then one final example that...
Oh, sorry to interrupt there. I was just going to say that I quite like that example because it seems well thought out insofar as how can we very pragmatically sort of install sort of these guardrails, even as we're opening up the space for feedback to be provided. Can we introduce some of these guardrails to make sure that we are guiding citizens in a meaningful and effective way so that when we are soliciting their input, we're being as targeted, as nuanced as we possibly can be, and not just have sort of an onslaught of opinions that are thrown your way and you're just flooded with all this. So I quite even like the distinction that you made there between opinion and expertise. It's not supposed to be an airing of grievances forum, but in fact, what has been your experience with this specific problem? So just wanted to add that. But yeah, do continue. I think you had another example that you were about to bring up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll actually just to tail off from what you were saying there, it's a very important point about not bombarding the decision maker with 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 ideas, which often there's someone, you want to make the life of the decision maker sort of easier as a result of this process, not harder. So you don't want to bombard them with 20,000 ideas that they can do nothing with. So when we say people-led innovation, it very much includes designing from the perspective of the decision maker and making it kind of more effective for the decision maker to do public engagement and making it something that they're that's not an additional burden for them, but rather something they can make part of their process. So one final example that I was going to share is called Civis. They are Civis is a group based out of Mumbai, and what they do is the government of India has a pre-legislative consultation policy, which is rarely, if ever, really implemented. But it's the idea that any draft legislation or regulation that the government of India puts out must be kept for public consultation for a certain period of time. And so what typically happens is, one, we almost never hear about the opportunity to provide feedback to these consultations because it's buried in page 7 of a newspaper that barely anybody reads. And so you'll almost never know of the opportunity. And second, even if you do find the opportunity, typically legislative documents are full of legalese and jargon and kind of hard to understand. And it's not easy for a layperson to respond to it. And so what Civis does is two very interesting things. One, they take this very complex legalese and jargony legislative document, and then they turn it into plain English that regular people can understand, which is already a win because you're now able to understand what is this thing about. And then they make it easy for you to provide your comments on how you would like it to be changed or what you agree with and what you disagree with. And then those comments are then delivered to government. It's a really neat tool. It's at civis.vote, and you should please take a look and see if there's consultations that you're interested in participating in. Everyone's comments are welcome. And I think that's it's one of those, again, a platform that it's not perfect. I think there's things that they're still working on improving. But it's a very creative way of again, allowing people to participate in a process that normally they wouldn't be able to.
Yeah, no, I quite like all of the solutions that you've sort of, or rather tools that you sort of highlighted for more effective sort of citizen engagement there. And I like quite how diverse the examples were from really all across the globe, that there are so many, if we, you know, stop to think about it, there are really a range of best practices that we could possibly be inspired from and draw from really as we are actively considering in the Indian context what it looks like to have more active engagement from citizens on a range of public policy issues. So I think maybe as we come sort of toward the end of our episode here, a question that I had really was, you know, we've sort of alluded to this fact that citizen engagement, people innovation might be this, I'm going to use a bit of a provocative phrasing here, but might be this Bermuda Triangle. We don't know what's happening there. Bit mysterious in the policymaking landscape. If you had to sort of venture a guess, you know, why do you think this is the case? How is this the case? And why really do you think this is the case?
I think I love that phrasing, that it's the kind of Bermuda Triangle of problem solving, because it often just gets lost in the conversation. My view on that is democracy fundamentally requires people's participation, not just once in 4 years. And it's something that I think, given the opportunity, more people would definitely participate in. The case that we've been trying to make is that public participation or public engagement is not just the more legitimate, the more transparent way of dealing with public problems, but it's also the more effective way to find solutions to public problems. Mm-hmm. And I think unless that case is made, unless the case for you should do public engagement because it works, because it's the better way to do things, until that case is made, I think people are hesitant to try and do something that, you know, is not part of normal practice, unfortunately. So it starts there. The second thing is that we don't want to make it sound like this is some futuristic aspirational process, right? We want public engagement. And
yeah, I was going to say, I think there may be some folks listening in who might think that's beautiful, you know, blue sky thinking of wonderful ways we want to engage with citizens. But yeah, so this, yeah, to continue, I don't want to interrupt your point there. So it's not, in fact, a very aspirational approach. Yeah.
Right. In the sense, you know, we want these mechanisms of evidence-based participatory processes to be accessible to anybody who wants to implement them. And I think the fact that we have so many open source tools and a whole ton of research that people have done over the years on this topic, to really make it easy for anybody who wants to experiment with one of these tools, you can do it. You can go out there today, and there's tools that you can take and tweak and sort of adapt to your own situation. And you don't have to do it at the large national scale or even at the state scale. You can do it very much within an MLA's constituency, or within, since we're in Bangalore, think about even at the sort of municipal level, how you can tackle problems by involving people at the municipal level. So the barrier of entry should be low, and I think the fact that there are so many of these tools out there that can help us, you know, run at least pilots to see how effective they are, should really encourage more people to take it. The third thing is that there is a lot of old school bureaucracy in how problems are tackled today. And there is a meme that some of our listeners might have seen, which is modern problems require modern solutions. I don't know if you have seen it. It's one of my favorite kind of memes on the internet. But really, it's just that, right? Like, there are institutions that are responsible for decision-making. These could be governments, it could be legislatures, nonprofits, it could be any institution that's working on public problems. And we all need to adopt new ways of working for the 21st century, because the problems we're facing are large, are complex, are global, and require interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary solutions. And we'll only get to that if we fundamentally believe that there is value in evidence-based decision-making and in participatory decision-making and in collaborative decision-making. And, you know, otherwise we will struggle to tackle the challenges that we're faced with. And so old-school bureaucracy, if you ask me, I don't think it works to tackle these problems. And so we need to provide a toolkit and sort of help develop the mindset within these institutions to upgrade themselves and make them sort of able to meet the challenges of the 21st century. And so to drive sustainable long-term change, we have to have a public service ecosystem, including civil service, including citizens, including legislatures and other institutions who are part of this, philanthropies, nonprofits, who are agile and who are able to work together and are constantly able to evolve and sort of learn and upskill these new ways of working.
Mm-hmm. No, I think those are really important points. You know, when I think of old school bureaucracy, you know, there are certain characteristics that come to mind, and I'd be curious to hear what comes to your mind what you mean when you say, you know, an old school bureaucracy. One of the things that comes to my mind is sometimes this idea of working with precedent. Like, if there is a precedent for something, we're going to maintain that status quo, and you know, we've seen it work, play out, and it sometimes is safer to say that we've tried this approach in the past, so I'd rather we replicate this approach again rather than, you know, be a bit pioneering and try something totally new that we have really no evidence to go on, whether it might be successful or it might not, or we don't know what other factors or variables may confound the way this plays out and how it's implemented. So that's what comes to mind sometimes when I think of, you know, maybe that old school bureaucracy thinking. Is there something that comes to mind that you'd like to, you know, bring to attention?
I have an instant response to that and a more thoughtful response to that. Okay. The instant response to that is, if you have watched the animated movie Zootopia, there is a scene in which there is a motor vehicles department that is entirely staffed by sloths, and they move really slowly, and they take, you know, 35 hours to make a photocopy. And that's the picture. Like, it's just a slow moving machine. And in some cases, for good reason, it's slow moving because it's got its checks and balances and accountability. So you don't want to be reckless and say, we'll change everything and it has to work like, work spontaneously. The more thoughtful response to that is, like you said, there's a little bit of inertia in the system. If there's something that's working, if there's a certain process, why change it? And I think giving, like I said a little bit earlier, like giving people the ability within the system, giving them the ability to try something new, almost like a sandbox for new policymaking, and letting them experiment and giving them some amount of leeway to try new things, with the guardrails that must come with, you know, working in the public sector, will be a very important need if we're going to change how we work. But other than that, I would say old school bureaucracy, it's not that the individuals are not interested in changing. It's just that the system is set up in that way that makes it pretty hard. I'll deviate for a second and give you one example that I remember working on a few years ago. We were working in a state government in the US with their motor vehicles department, actually. And the problem that they were facing was that there's these really long lines outside the motor vehicles departments of people trying to access services. And very often people are taking the day off from work to come there. And they show up at the counter after waiting in a very long line and realize they don't have the right documents, or they've come with, you know, the wrong mode of payment or something. And they have to go back and they're really frustrated at the end of it. It's not great. They haven't received the service they need to receive. And so we sat down with the sort of team at the top of that department, and then we said, "Let's look at your website. Let's see, you know, what information's on the website." Because the staff at the agency said, "All the documents that you need are listed on the website. Why don't people bring the right documents? They would save everybody's time." And we looked at that website, and it was so complicated for people to navigate. And it had so much kind of legal language in there that was just simply hard for people to understand. And the staff themselves looked at that website and said, "This is crazy. We've really got to simplify how people find this information." And just putting that in front of them, we did nothing. Our role was to go, "Here's what your customers are seeing. Do you think this is helping them get where they should be?" And their answer was no. And so they themselves rewrote the content for the website. And then said, you know, "If we make it easier for people to access this information, then perhaps they will come back to the agencies with the right set of documents and things." And while they were in that process, they realized there's several things you don't need to come into the agency for at all. There are things that you could just enable people to do online. And so just exposing these people, and they're really so passionate about improving the way the agency works. It's just they've never been given the block of time that we were able to sort of force them into, in order to just think about these processes. And the moment you give them that opportunity, they're willing to make that change. And there's interest and there's skills and there's the passion to make that change. So I think giving people the opportunity to upgrade the way that they work will actually drive some change. And I'm not as cynical about it as some people might be, even though I have this Zootopia vision in my mind.
I'm going to try and shake the image of sloths from my mind as we wrap this podcast, but it may mean that I have to rewatch the movie is what it's telling me. But I think that's a helpful example that you bring up, Anirudh, because it to me shows that, you know, there's opportunity in these types of processes to pull up a bit of a magnifying glass to say, let's examine this problem a little bit closer and let's see if we can catch, some nuance here that we may miss when we're just quickly trying to get to that solution stage like we were discussing earlier, right? So if it were up to me, we would continue talking for another hour because I think I have my different points that I'd like to continue and make some inroads in. But for this, the lack of time, I think we may have to slowly wrap up here. And maybe a parting question I could have is, we've covered a lot of good ground. We've traveled in our examples from Iceland to Japan. We were in Kerala briefly. But if you had to leave our listeners today with, you know, three key takeaways that you think you'd like to bring to their attention, and if they were to leave this podcast saying, okay, these are the three things that I remember from what Anirudh taught me today or brought up today, what would you say are the three sort of key ideas for you?
The first thing I would say is something I hear on the streets of Bangalore all the time, which is, "What's your problem? What's your problem, man? Just ask what is your problem," constantly. And I think we should start thinking about that more intentionally. The second is that well-designed public engagement makes problem solving more equitable, makes it more legitimate, and perhaps most importantly, it makes it more effective at driving better outcomes. And so it's not just some sort of, you know, window dressing or showcase democracy where it's for the sake of it. There's actual value in doing it. And then finally, there are tools out there. There's a lot of research out there. There's a lot of material out there that anybody can access in order to try these new ways of working. And we can experiment with the methodology and we can try new things. But we have to really create that mindset of collaborative, participatory problem solving if we want our democracy to be really democratic. So I think that's where I would leave our listeners.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. Some powerful closing words over there, Anirudh. And really, really helpful, I think, for us to have this conversation. Always a relevant topic to be discussing. But thank you so much for your time, your expertise, for being so generous with your knowledge. It's been a real treat to have you. So thank you so much. And I leave our listeners to click next to our next episode there. But thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you for having me, Kripa.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.